public lecture by Anita Roddick, Dame Anita Roddick, on behalf of the Centre for Civil Society. I'm delighted to introduce Dame Anita Roddick this evening, who I'm sure actually doesn't need any introduction at all. But if there's anybody here who has not heard of Dame Anita Roddick or The Body Shop, I'll just fill you in with a few details. The Body Shop was set up in 1976 by Dame Anita Roddick, and as she put it, simply to create a livelihood for myself and my two daughters while her husband, Gordon, was trekking across the Americas. And she claims she had no training or experience in business, and her husband gave her the wise advice of just try to take sales of £300 a week. And now, as we all know, The Body Shop is a multi-local business with over almost 2,000 stores. 2,200 stores, serving 77 million customers in 50 different markets and in 25 different languages and across 12 time zones. And as we know, The Body Shop has a very important mission, which is to dedicate its business to the pursuit of social and environmental change. Anita has been very active, not only as a businesswoman, but as a civil society activist. She was part of a campaign with other NGOs to seek justice and reparation for the Ogoni people in Nigeria against the giant oil multinational Shell that was ravaging through their lands with oil exploration. And that was a successful campaign. In 2001, again, joining forces with other environmental NGOs, she was part of a major international campaign against Exxon Mobil Esso. She's also initiated community trade initiatives as part of her Body Shop work. And although she's no longer on the executive committee of the Body Shop, she still spends time on Body Shop business, and has also set up her own publications company, which is called Anita Roddick Publications. And I love this next line. She likes to describe it as, we manufacture weapons of mass instruction. And as part of the publications company, she's been involved recently in two major campaigns, one on sweatshop labor and the other on human rights issues around American political prisoners, known as the Angola Three. So I'm delighted to be able to welcome Anita to the LSE, and I'm sure we're all looking forward to her talk this evening. Thank you.
Thank you. At the end of this talk, some of you will be saying, damned Anita Roddick on this stuff. I've got a slide presentation, and it's really important that you see the slides. So at some stage, those lights will be dimmed, and I can get on with it. But I want to be able to... This is not going to be a spectacularly happy presentation, because it hasn't worked, corporate social responsibility. And I know at my age, women have become radical as they become older, and that's their life, and God help anybody who gets in our way. And I love being challenging, because it's like being an iconoclast. But this is what this area of challenging corporate social responsibility breaks my heart. In short, I don't believe with... Oh, I've got to put a slide on. Let's see if they go. Oh, have I screwed up? No, I'll try this one. Yeah. Now, can you see that? Is that light? Does that light need to go down there? They promised me it would be down. It's some good slides. If you can't see it, chant or clap slowly. In short, I don't believe with hand on heart that corporate social responsibility has worked. I think there are a number of assumptions. Speak up a bit. Okay, I'll get nearer. There we go. Can you hear me now? Is that better? There we go. I believe there are a number of assumptions behind this business movement that we need to put under the spotlight. Yes, you can. This is like teenage sex. But this is probably more.
Okay.
Oh shit! Can we put it? This is probably more memorable. This bit, right? Okay. You know, just, that's it, compromise here, that's it, we want to know about this. And I hoped, what I hope to do at the end of the day with huge, I hope, grace, is to show you the true face behind the fact that CSR, we'll call it, not corporate social responsibility, has become merely a branch of public relations and is totally incapable of fulfilling its promises. And you could see that a few weeks ago as thousands gathered at that fenced off alpine resort called Davos for the traditional New Year gathering. And you find there so many NGOs and so many progressive thought leaders who are calling on politicians to take responsibility for the ethical operation of companies and not to surrender it to those business peddling fine words. The image of companies working hard to make the world a better place is too often just that, a carefully manufactured image. So my target tonight, if there is a target, is that burgeoning industry known as CSR, which is now seen as a vital tool for promoting and improving the public image of some of the world's largest companies and some of the most heinous corporations. Some of those shouting the loudest about their corporate virtues are also among those inflicting some of the worst damage on communities where they work, particularly poor communities. What is needed now are legally binding regulations to lessen the devastating effect and impact that companies can have in this ever more marginalized, globalized world. However, whichever way you look at it, it's been a terrific strategy, as over the past decade, companies have used this image of CSR to oppose regulation and convince governments in rich countries that business can put its own house in order. Business can put its own house in order. Thousands of us are in opposition to most politicians, including Tony Blair and the United Nations, who really believe that the voluntary approach is best. I don't believe that. I see it as completely inadequate, and what is needed now are internationally legally binding standards. Many of us are still trying to undermine the assumptions that make business conferences all about increased rate of growth, the global competitiveness, and little about stronger communities and healthier children, all about the march of progress, but little about the people and cultures that are trampled on underfoot. I'm not a loony do-gooder, traipsing the world, hugging trees, staring into crystals. I'm a trader. I love buying and selling. I'm a merchant for longer than I care to tell. I've established, as we've heard, one of the most interesting and effective, successful international retailing companies. To give some facts, 2,300 stores, 54 countries, 27 languages, you said 9 time zones. So I'm not opposed to trade or change in word or deed, but not necessarily as the only solution in this world. I'm concerned about the quality of trade, not just the quantity. For me, when I was running the company, The Body Shop, my goal was never about being 20 times bigger. It was about being better by being values-led. Now, it's true, no doubt about this, my thinking was forged in the 60s. And in those days, I would have slipped my wrist rather than ever think I'd be working in any institution or in corporate America or England, or even see myself as an astute business person. But I always regard myself as one of those who paved the way for what we now regard as a social responsibility movement, and one that desperately tried to put idealism back on the agenda. But I wanted to go further. To be worthy of that name, social responsibility, we need a new paradigm for business, a whole new framework for seeing and understanding what business can and must be a force for positive change. It mustn't just, avoid hideous evil, it must actively do good. And more than that, I wanted to go beyond rules. I wanted us to internalize these ethics, because it seems to me that if business comes with no moral sympathy or honorable code of behavior, then God help us all. Because it's for the first time in our cultural history, businesses is center stage. It's richer, it's faster, it can turn on a dime than any other social institution. It's more powerful than politics. It's now more powerful than religion. And if it doesn't have this type of thinking, we're all shot to hell. Because let's be clear what we're up against. If we're really serious about corporate responsibility, we're stepping out of line with the prevailing version of the free market economies that now dominates the globe. I don't want to be part of a CSR mindset that is simply a mild form of the status quo. If I use this label, I want to use it authentically to bear witness that something else is important, and that's radical. So this is what we should do, and this is how I think we should behave. First of all, we must stand up against the idea that the world should and can be run by a handful of transnational corporations, turning into a playground for any one of us who can move capital and projects quickly from place to place. We stand up against the idea that business can make everyone better off by roaming from country to country with no restrictions, in search of the lowest wages, the most passive and docile workers, the loosest environmental regulations, and the most docile thinkers. And not a word about human rights. So to make a stand against this sort of prevailing climate of this new nomadic capital that never sets down roots, never builds communities, that leaves behind nothing but toxic waste and embittered workers. And it means confronting the lies that we just lie back and accept if we're not careful, and especially the lies about money and value. Because the current status quo only measures money. It's a kind of survival of the economically fittest by their interpretation of the fit, the marketable, the profitable, the global. It's pathetically inadequate. It's a kind of fascism, really, and I don't think that's putting it too strongly, just as fascism was a perversion of Darwin's survival theories. I remember being challenged in the early days when I went into the stock market and I looked at these guys, and I said, pinstripe dinosaurs. And all hell broke out. Now I'm calling them financial fascists, and all hell breaks out. The financially fit survive. Those that don't fit, people and communities and nations are bled dry. The status quo of a moral business is a devastating machine that can bear no variation, and it's building the kind of world that most of us don't want, of this non-moral business. And I've got some interesting facts here. The corporate pioneer, John D. Rockefeller, once boasted, quote, that he was quite willing to pay someone a salary of $1 million if they were brutal enough, to quote him. He must be able to glide over every moral restraint with almost childlike disregard, he wrote, and has, beside other positive qualities, no scruples whatsoever, and be able and ready to kill off thousands of victims without a murmur, close quote. If you pretend that business is beyond morality, that's the kind of morality you get. We're consistently told that the alternatives to this present system are not feasible. So what we need to be is get, what I think we need now is a good old-fashioned dose of heresy. We need modern heretics. So that's the heart of the message I want to put across. Authentic corporate social responsibility is a heresy. And I want us to be proud of that and realize the implications. I worry now, after 10, 15 years of this, that we're not nearly heretical enough. Now listen to this other quote I found. Productivity, like patriotism, is not enough. What our free world desperately needs is a sense of human purpose which transcends the awe-inspiring material achievement of modern technology and big business. And individual men and women need inspiration beyond personal gain. Being bent on merely making money and thinking that the only good is what pays are hopelessly uninspiring and really dreadfully unattractive. And I guess some of you may know who wrote that. Was it last year? Was it possibly 1990? Actually, it was written by Sir Jock Campbell in The Listener in January 1959. We've been here a long time, in other words, and over the past 40 years since Campbell wrote that article, the power, the resources, and influence of business has been vastly increasing. Yet we seem to have made precious little progress in being more reflective and more responsible. It's true that the basic argument of corporate responsibility put forward since the 1980s by organizations like Business in the Community have been won. It does make economic sense for companies to safeguard their business environment. It does make economic sense for companies to think beyond their bottom line. Yet mainstream business thinking manages both to behave as if it's their only darn duty was to the bottom line, and their senior executives just piously argue otherwise. That's why it's still possible to accuse some of the most vociferous proponents of corporate responsibility of having stick on ethics, or to point into their built-in preference to photogenic projects, preferably with children, rather than the less popular issues like refugees, human rights, workers' justice, and social alienation. And it's got to be more than that, because business now is probably the only force on earth capable of making a difference. So if we don't do it, speak up more. Okay, bear with me. How many of you are deaf? Right, okay. And it's, okay, is this better? Is it really you can't hear me? Oh God, shall I say it all again? No. Okay, business can and must be a force for social change. We're the only group that can make this happen in business, but we're strangely incompetent when it comes to the point. I've been reading about the findings of the trip by Dara O'Rourke, an assistant professor at MIT, and he went with PricewaterhouseCoopers to audit sweatshops in Korea and Indonesia. He found that the auditors had no knowledge of labor issues. He found that they gave the companies 10 days advance warning with a letter telling them that what would be inspected. He heard them asking managers to put the wage and hours data into the spreadsheets for the workers. And, you know, in Korea, they even found auditors skipping the questions on workers' rights to organize in employee interviews, explaining they don't have a union in this factory, so these questions aren't really relevant. He even overheard them advising sweatshop managers had to go get around employment rules. This is all the more extraordinary, it seems to me, because if there were problems about quality or financial irregularity, these apparently powerless multinationals, those who commissioned the auditors in the first place would know exactly what to do with it. My question now is, why has the corporate responsibility movement become so obsessed with figures? I'm not saying that social auditing isn't worth it. Of course it is. It's important that companies report on their social and environmental achievements as well, but it has to be transparent. We pioneered social auditing years ago in the body shop with the caveat that everybody knew about it, all the stockholders. When we found out that suppliers had found some 7% of irregularities in our purchasing department, you know, not the fact that 93% were pretty honorable, we put it up there. When we found out, to our absolute dismay, the majority of our employees didn't think our training was adequate enough, and we thought we were brilliant brilliant. We put it up for everybody to see, every share, every stockholder, everybody invested in the success of the body shop. And for us, you know, it's got to be now a common requirement on companies to report. But there is no common standard. These glossy social reports are about as useful as their financial accounts would be if they all used different techniques. That's got to change. Social auditing based on the idea of the triple bottom line, that is how the performance of companies, how they should be judged, not by just their financial balance sheet, but their environmental and social performance, we again pioneered in the body shop. And I know some people believe social auditing is responsible for the sort of the current malaise in corporate social responsibility, because what used to capture the imagination of chief executives, a chance to think about the future and what might be possible, is now just handed over to the auditors and the audit-minded. The problem with auditing is that it hands the whole social responsibility caboodle over to technocrats, as if somehow they can deal with morality on our behalf. And it is, let's face it, deadly, deadly, deadly dull. You can have all your metrics right and still be laying waste on the earth. The point is that there is only one bottom line that counts, and that's conscience. And anything that separates us as business people from conscience is as much as a threat to the solution. In fact, the whole accounting mindset, in my experience, gets in the way of executives understanding that what are the real consequences of their decisions. And to this day, I've yet to find one business school that is still obsessed with these dull studies of companies through their, you know, through their case studies. Don't go and send the students back to see the actual result of their actions. Maybe Harvard and Stanford, maybe Columbia should take people into the sweatshops in Nicaragua and in Honduras and in Korea and in Indonesia and in Saipan and in you know, China, just to see the results of this. And they don't. And I believe that, you know, what we have to have now is this, to take these disasters of globalization personally and not just see them as externalities, as the rational business people seem to do. So let me just give you some stories. And I've held mutated babies, genetically handicapped by toxic waste dumps in local streams. And then I was doing this, one of these worst talks you ever did, and the trick to never tell them what you're talking about, at the International Chamber of Commerce in Cancun. And what I did, and which is really smart of me all the time, is I travel in the area, and I traveled in the Sierra Madres Mountains in, this is Sarawak, in Mexico, and with the Penan people, who are consistently being used, you know, on the mountainside with, for the tobacco industry, British American Tobacco, every other one. Now, they were banned, the pesticides were banned in America, but being still used by the Sarawak peasants, still used by the farmers in Mexico. Every child that was born when I visited them was born with no genitalia. And so I took photographs of this and came back to this International Chamber of Commerce, who were there at this one of these social gatherings. And I remember, for me, this was a particularly shocking time because scientists had tracked down the cause of the pesticides. The American tobacco companies that brought the crops grown wouldn't accept responsibility because they said the fields didn't belong to them. And knowing that representatives of those companies would be in Cancun, I showed them the slides. And this kind of confrontation isn't really smart to do, but there's sometimes no alternative. But what was the response was really, really bizarre. There was no reaction at all. There was no embarrassment. There was no shifting of the bottom on the chair. There was just a bloodless sense of good manners. And I was chilled by that experience in Cancun because they weren't just ordinary people. They are the world's leaders in business. They were probably some of the few individuals that could do something about it. And that's what these figures don't show you. And this is like in Sarawak, when I was invited by the Penan to film the duo of the 24-hour logging by Mitsubishi. Now, this was the most dangerous trip I have ever done in my life. Myself and my stupidly brought my daughter along with me. And I can remember the 24 hours just trooping into the forest with leeches everywhere in your body and being, just know that you, if the log is caught you, you'd be dead in a day. And, you know, and I looked at this incredible small group of people, this tribe there, who did their, you know, who did this, who were confronting by this whole body of people and individuals that was a human blockade. And for me, when I look at that type of thing against the big multinational corporations, I have to ask myself the question, where is our media on this? Where is the shame that our media could be showing us? Why isn't this on annual general reports and accounts? Why isn't this measured in terms of their financial success? So why not change the way we work? Too much auditing and indicators and numbers encourages a sort of passive approach to responsibility. Refraining from doing harm rather than being ambitious enough and having the imagination enough to take some positive contribution by changing the way we do business. And it reminded me that one of the best, you know, one of the times in your life when you want to go to somebody you think is a great mentor or somebody you've admired. And I remember finally getting a chance to spend time with Naomi Klein. This is postmenopausal forgetting of memory, not only Ralph Nader, but Noam Chomsky. And I remember, if anybody's ever gone to his office, it's like, it's just the walls of books. It's about half the size of this platform. He's academic, who lives in his work. And I remember waiting patiently, just wanting to talk to him about some of these ideas I had. And I came away, not with the tail between my legs, but with a real understanding. It's like an epiphany. He said, nothing will change until the financial institutions change. Nothing will change. And, you know, that's for me, and I thought there has got to be a way around this. And how do you bring fierce humanity into a company that is on the stock market, that has to be, you know, responsible for maximizing, for doing good products, but not at the expense of its workers, not at the expense of human rights? And I found a way, and maybe it's because I was Italian and therefore pathologically optimistic, and the way that I found was community trade. I thought then, and still do, that it's time to declare that trade lacking justice, equity, decency, and compassion are no longer acceptable. Economics, efficiency perceptions, brutish power calculations no longer suffice. The bottom line has bottomed out. And the light at the end of the tunnel against this looming disaster of poverty is to support the local grassroots economic initiatives. And let me tell you a bit about some of the, you know, the ones I've been in. In 1992, I visited a village in Ghana, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing it wrong, Banyayili. And it's a we had a commitment to work with a women's cooperative there. And they had used appropriate technology developed for the processing of shea nuts, which were able to produce large quantities for shea butter than traditional methods allowed. In 1994, you know, some 10 years ago plus, they produced 25 tons of excess for their needs, which they offered to fair trade with us. It was the beginning of the Fair Trade Body Shops Community Trade Program in Africa. And we're trying to link trade directly with communities. And the way we allowed for them, when we purchased directly with them, because it's a purchasing program, their monies went back, their profits went back into the community. So this is some years later, 3 or 4 years back, when I went to visit them. 13 villages have changed the status of women there because of this cooperative movement. They now have a livelihood. They pay for books and uniforms for their kids. We've built schools. We've got clean water. They can call on health workers when they're ill or a midwife when they're pregnant. Young girls who would once automatically been put out to work filling the sweatshops in the cities now get an opportunity and an education. And we shove it in that. Let me tell you, skincare products are not the body and blood of Jesus Christ. They're water and oil emulsions. If you can find a value in them, it is finding ways of getting the community, mostly in poor and frail communities, to trade with you directly and being honorable about your relationship with them. I once saw a quote in a bank in India, a village bank or a place where they exchange money. And it was a quote of Mahatma Gandhi, and he was defining spirituality. And he defined it, the quote was on the wall, as being in service for the weak and the frail. I cannot think of a better message for big corporate businesses for being in service to the weak and the frail. So this is our body. Now let me just tell you one of Teddy Exports in India. This is another one of our fair trade community successes. Our friendship, our relationship with Tamil Nadu in southern India, one of the poorest states in southern India, goes back, I think, to about 1987, when we first brought these massage rollers from them. It was we have a footsie roller, we've got the twin ball massage roller, and it became, you know, Body Shop classics. They used to cut down the acacia tree in this community for firewood. We suggested that they cut it down and keep the root intact. But use their the barks and the boughs for and the branches for these massage rollers. It employs 500 people. It's predominantly female workers, previously unskilled agricultural workers who had no job, and we had just a casual basis of work. Everybody has a full-time salary, stable work, no determination, no discrimination on the basis of religion or caste. First thing the community did when they got the money from our trading is to build a school, 219 students, 13 teaching staff on campus. Disabled kids are always coming in from the Tirumangalam, and the teachers leave the school and teach women in the sex workers industry another trade. There's a school bus that takes the kids to work, to school, and there are thousands and thousands of livestock, 17,000 livestock, that have been treated this year by the veterinary clinic. And we have the best AIDS awareness program because we attach all our information and our sexually transmitted disease clinics along the side of garages. Truck drivers pass on AIDS in India. And there's nothing more heartening when you see the truck drivers stop, pick up a girl, jump over the wall near where the garage is and have their way, except our medic students who work in the clinic jump over the wall too, tap them on the shoulder, offer them a Durex. It's the best form of coitus interruptus known to man, and it works. So these are the stories. This is what we had to learn. You had to learn to dialogue, metaphorically take tea with these people for a year, understand. There was a sense of reflection that you don't get when you're a public company, because everything is about a hurry sickness, trying to get, you know, more and more profits, more and more, keeping the city, as Noam Chomsky said, happy. So for me, this is what is the soul of my company. Take this away. Take this out of the company's ideology or action, and we're just the same as any other dime a dozen cosmetic company. And what breaks your heart, and I'm into the breaking of the heart mode tonight, is that very, very, very few companies do this. For 5 years, I've been writing to Avon, biggest cosmetic company, 600,000 women working on selling Avon cosmetic in Brazil alone. Can I get them to purchase sesame oil from the Nicaraguan farmers? Can I get them like hell? If anybody knows anybody who works in Avon who is major that might be connected here, because you never know who comes to this school, please let me know. So there's a growing movement of people who are determined to want to know the story behind the product, to know the face of it. And, you know, they want to know. They make the decisions, like many of you here who are choosing not to buy products made from sweatshops with child labor from companies that are distorting the environment. So, and I think what with this new movement of people are acting more like ethical watchdogs than hungry consumers. And it's very powerful. So I choose myself. I choose not to buy from certain brands. I don't want to buy flowers from Colombia, for example, because I know the diseases caused by the pesticides the women are enduring in the flower industry. I don't want to buy from Total. I'm not keen on Shell because of their practices in Nigeria and Burma. And that makes me a very difficult one to find a garage for a start. But it makes me a vigilante consumer. And there are lots of us, and our activities go much more than just boycotting, which is really dangerous to do in the fashion industry, in the garment industry. We are campaigning, we are funding, and we're advocating for change. Never underestimate the power of this new vigilante consumer. No company can afford to ignore them. Look at the animal rights movement, the consumer assaults on L'Oreal or Gillette. Now they're being joined by the human rights lobby or joining the ranks of the ethical investors, consumer boycotters, direct action specialists in spotting the so-called business agenda. And therefore, in my view, rightfully making business the target of protest. I remember when I was at the Seattle protest in 1999, was it? A Shell official said to me there, he said, "We don't fear regulation anymore. We control regulation. What we fear is consumer revolt." Which brings me to these lies in the myths of this business. Too long business. What are the myths? They've been teaching you in schools that politics and community organizing are two different arenas. They're not. I believe political awareness and activism must be incorporated into global management. In a global world, there is no values-free or politically disentangled actions. Now, however expressed, values carry a message of shared purpose, standards and conceptions of what is worth living for and what is worth striving for, and they have mass motivating power. There are not many more motivating forces more potent than giving your employees or your customers an opportunity to exercise and express their idealism to influence change, whether it's locally or whether it's globally, whether it's nationally. And this is how we did it in the Body Shop, and I'm using the past tense. We turned our shops into action stations. Now, a smart marketing guy would say, great marketing is being where customers, you know, where competition fear to go. Except it never made us money. Because if we put a big campaign in the shops, and it wasn't just a poster campaign, it was information, it was education, it was everything. Guess what? The sales slipped. Not a lot, but they slipped. So it wasn't too difficult to work out that other companies would realize that our sales slipped. Because, you know, we were coming into organizing, corralling the public on social messages. So, but what it did for the employees, I mean, our turnover rate in retaining is really high. Our turnover rate was less than 30%. People wanted to stay. They were being educated. They felt that there was more to life than a Monday to Friday sort of dying. And they were being educated in the workplace. As they were given the role of doing community trade, they were paid to do it. You come into the body shop then, we said part of your remit for working out is doing community volunteering. You choose what you want to do. As long as it's not doing golf, you can do anything. And that was incredibly empowering for our employees. So we turned, and this is on another, and one I thought was really nice. It was banned in some in some airports where we, look how many of our friends now are gone. We're against testing on animals, but using despots wherever is another matter. We have makeup on their faces. 28 years we've been against animal testing. In November 1996, you know, we changed the law in this country. 4 million people came up and signed petitions and made their voice heard. 4 million people. And now, guess what? Here we are advancing this huge company. We're opening up in Russia this year. We're opening up in India. We cannot get into China. We're banned from going into China because we don't test our products in animals. So China has ostensibly barred us from entering that market because we refuse to test our products in animals. What a life. Anyway, what an irony. However easy it is to hug a tree and save a bunny rabbit, it's always been really, really difficult talking about business's role in human rights and right abuses. We've run a campaign on domestic violence in many countries around the world, being very smart with this one, finding things like, you know, disused mobiles, getting them back reconfigured, giving them to women as an emergency button. And so still our campaign goes on, but much more focused on women's issues, much more focused on community trade. I remember in the old days when we first had our first relationship with Amnesty. And it's very, for me, and they gave us 33 prisoners of conscience to work on behalf of freeing. And this is one of the offices in our, above one of our stores where our staff and our customers would go in and write a letter. And I remember 6 months later, 17 prisoners of conscience were released. And the girls who were working, who were mostly Moroccan, it seemed to me, if I can recall, in our Piccadilly store, when their prisoner of conscience that they had worked so hard, assiduously in getting released was released, there was a joy. There was a sense of joy when that happened. So 17 we managed to change. And then we came up with a wonderful campaign we did just before I left the body shop called Make Your Mark, where we got 12 million signatures of support for human rights defenders around the world. And it has to be said, when you act, campaigning for human rights is tough. And often it seems like we get millions of signatures, write hundreds of letters, jump up and down, and still get nowhere. Those we fight for continue to rot in prisons, and people continue to have their rights violated. Campaigning is our point of difference and separates Body Shop from the most other companies. And that's another heartbreaking thing. Why don't other companies really campaign? But our campaigns are really deemed either really damn stupid or brave. And as I said, there's this consistent drop in whatever we do. But the pride. But when you open up a campaign on our human rights, defend the defenders, and the world's greatest spiritual leader was there to welcome us, and one of the great human rights activists in Africa was there, you know you're doing something wrong, right. And when we can, and not for the media. And then I remember when we finished the campaign in Paris with an amazing pop concert, and you know I'm just dying wobbly at the knees because there's my fave Bruce Springsteen, and I'm sitting talking to him about kids. Can you believe it? And all these people gather, and he came on, you know, Dalai Lama came on, just said, I'm going to speak to these 140,000 people at this concert. And he walked to the very edge of the stage, and he opened up his arms, and he said, this is, look at your happy faces. There was something that was tangible about, you know, the fierceness of love and affection, and doing it through an avenue of how we made our money. It's how we made our money. And this is what we wanted to do with it. And to this day, I'm so proud that we never gave these obscene pay packages to our so-called then, we didn't have an executive committee. I was called the founder of the, you know, I was called the just the founder. Gordon was called the founder's hubby, and that was about it. So what I've found in the corporate enthusiasm for CSR is not driven primarily by the desire of the lot of the communities in which companies work. Rather, companies concerned with their own reputations, with the potential of public campaigns directed against them, an overwhelming desire and the imperatives to ever-increasing profits. It's no more than reputation management. And none of this means that companies cannot act responsibly, but it does mean that their attempts to do so are likely to be partial and patchy and still leave communities at risk. So this is what I think the UK government should do. Number one, adopt new laws to make corporate and social and environmental reporting and disclosure mandatory for British companies, including the disclosure of payment to overseas governments, information of the social and environmental impact of overseas operations, and details of legal actions against companies. You can see I'll be popular on that one. Number two, frame new responsibilities for company directors to give them a duty of care to communities and the environment, making them legally accountable for their company's actions overseas, but not at the expense, right? They can make their money and maximize their profits, but not at the expense of the environment, human rights, public health and safety, dignity of employees, and the welfare of communities in which the companies operate. I think that's 29 words. 29 words could change business practice forever. Number three, finally, change the law to enable people harmed by British companies overseas and overseas operations to seek redress in UK courts and to provide the resources to enable them to do them. So what I'm looking for, as I said at the beginning of the talk, is binding regulations. So to move from CSR to corporate social accountability, that means companies in the future will have to legally oblige to uphold international standards. Then, I think, and only then will things change. Will the corporate world live up to the name of its professed commitments in dealing with some of the world's poorest people? I computer graphically changed this. This is a trading bay in, I think, in America. Put Jesus Christ up there. And I realized that, this is in one of the books I did, I realize still today that the markets, stock markets, reward toughness. Oh my God, do they reward downsizing, cost-cutting? They don't reward ethical behavior or imaginative social responsibility. Quite the reverse. These innovations are often ridiculed in the major investment magazines like Forbes and Fortune. And I remember when we opened up the Body Shop, we opened up a soap factory in Glasgow, then one of the most, declared one of the poorest community in Western Europe. 75% of this particular community, Easter House in Glasgow, where all the kids up to 25 were out of work. So we used to buy our soaps from Turkey, and then we found some of the working practice, so we shifted it out, said, let's open up a factory in Easter House and make it bloody amazing. Make it the best factory, get the best pay, and let's put 25% of the profits back into the community. Even before we opened up, we built a child adventure playground, bringing in the UK military to help us. They're always very good at adventure playgrounds. We opened up community centres. One of the biggest problems that we find in our society now is loneliness, especially in this country where we're the oldest people in Western Europe now, even older than Italy. And one of the big demanding, any business, any product that shaves away loneliness is going to be a light at the end of the tunnel, and it's going to be a business or an enterprise that lasts forever. Whenever there we were doing all this stuff and expecting, I guess, naively a pat on the back, the financial journalists slated us. We were stealing money from the shareholders' pockets. They were doing, the Milton Friedman stuff. And I remember when we were challenged at a annual general meeting, when we did the visits to the share market, to the stock market, dealers. They challenged Gordon and I on this, and I remember the best, I'd just seen that, a wonderful movie where the strap line was up your bum. So I remember saying to one of these investors, it's up your bum, I don't care, this is the way we run our company, I want to make it breathless, exciting, and relevant. So up your bum was my rallying cry. So we've got, I think, a trade system, as you well know, many of you here, because you live it and live in countries, it's so unbalanced that no amount of reputation management can make a blind bit of difference. So what did we do about CSR then? It seems to me that we have a responsibility beyond what we do in our own companies to be vigilant around the world, to lobby for an enforceable international code of conduct that should underpin these efforts we're making. We have the power, but we haven't quite understood it yet. We can't quite believe it or how to apply it. And this sort of hesitancy plays into the hands of the people whose interests we're challenging. So for me, it's about heresy. And if there's anything more than the glossy brochures and the checklist auditing and the corporate social responsibility is not changing the world, it's got to be more than this stuff. And if it's not, we're in such clear danger of seriously deepening the cynicism about business that's so common around the world and of an intolerant backlash against everything it stands for. There is a gentler, there is a kinder, there is a better way of doing business where core values of community, of social justice, of openness, of environmental care and awareness can flourish. But that means about being ambitious, and it means being grown up enough to take responsibility for the way the world is. We have to show more developed emotions than fear and greed. And so far, corporate social responsibility has been fiddling around at the edges, but I believe we can have the courage of our convictions so that the world wakes up and takes notice. We're really a long way from it, despite all the effort. So my idea would be, let's wrestle the control of the agenda from the marketing departments and from the auditors and find ways of putting it into the hearts of everyone in business from the shop floor to the very top. And if we could come together to discuss discover a common ground for trade justice, it might mean reporting, treating ideas as news. It might mean a media more critical of the corrupt and less sarcastic about the idealistic. It might mean compiling indicators of a good and just society rather than those of a prosperous and efficient one. It might even mean a country that asked why as often as it asked when or how much, and a culture that was concerned about the way something was done as well as that just something was. Finally, it might be a country that just in time paused to ask the question, what is the right, the just, the moral thing for us to do? And it might find that just by asking the question, we've already come and become better people. So let's challenge everything we've been told as a necessary fact of business life. Let's be awed by our responsibility and excited about the possibilities. Thank you very much.
That was very inspiring, and I'd like now to open it up to questions. And at this point, I want to ask anybody who plans to leave in the next half hour to please leave now so that we can have an uninterrupted question and answer session. And if anybody upstairs would like to come down here, please do, as there are spare seats. Do you want to take questions clustered together in one by one?
One by one?
Okay. I may do two or three together so we can go towards the end.
You can say that later. You want to get a copy of my speech and do it on my website.
Yeah. So I think that means we have here the vigilante consumers. Very good. Anita's asked me to let you know that a copy of her speech will be available on the website, on her website. Okay, I'm going to take questions now, and in the spirit of maximising participation, can I please ask you to keep your questions direct and not precede them with a long speech about your life or your beliefs? Okay, thank you. Yes, the gentleman over here.
In your talk, you talk a lot about the government's need to regulate trade, but do you think there's also a role of government to regulate consumerism and to get away from the idea that, for example, to take the example of Body Shop, that beauty can be sold in a bottle? Is that not more a greater problem?
I think one of the... let me think about this. I think there's not enough talking about frugality. That this sort of elegant frugality that only the rich talk about is fine, but there isn't enough choice. Now, I've heard something that came to me. Somebody rang me up yesterday and talked about this a notion of renting, that so many things should be rented now, like computers, because they're always advancing them, you know, that instead of purchasing, there should be a renting system that would, things that become obsolete, you can just get them changed and exchanged. And it was just a top line, somebody chatting to me about that. I think there's a nub of a great idea in that. I don't think it's going to be hard. For me, I'd like that. But I'm, you know, pariah if I say that. I think no car company should make these bloody 4x4s. I think there should be, you have something in what Volkswagen has made the fastest car on this planet, like who needs it? So I think there should be some regulation. Now, when it comes to, you know, bloody shampoo, I can't get that excited about. There's choice, I guess. But you know, it's very interesting because I've always wanted to have a shop which had just basics, you know, basic shampoo, the best, you know, the best you can make it, basic skin, just four things, and you actually find that when you do get older, you have far less. Have a look at your bathroom cabinet. I think it's only got probably got 16 things in there. Well, for women, you've got 25 lipsticks, you're right. I don't think we can audit that or control that. But it's a shame, but I wish it could happen, but it's not.
Thank you. Yes, the young woman just in the middle.
Hello, my name is Mona. I have a question on the against animal testing. I was wondering, can you make sure the products are safe before you test on the animals? And plus, in certain industries such as pharmaceutical, if the products haven't been tested on the animals, how can people be there to use it in the first place?
Right, let's separate cosmetics from pharmaceuticals. Cosmetics, the first cousin of cosmetics is food. Everything you eat, you can put on your body. Everything you grow in your garden, mostly you can put on your body. So there's the aligning. So you have thousands of years of like using the past as your prologue for ideas. You just go anywhere in any pre-industrial societies and they're using what they grow to clean, to polish, and to, you know, protect the skin and hair. I think, and the other thing against animal testing within the cosmetic industry, and I'm staying with the cosmetic industry, animal skin isn't the same as human skin. Animal skin doesn't blush, animal skin is different. There are also far better techniques, much more rigorous cell culture testing, in vitro testing, skin patch testing. So I think the whole notion of animal testing within the cosmetic industry is really obsolete. But the biggest plank in the platform of this cosmetic industry's profit is anti-aging. And what they're tending to do is using pharmaceutical ingredients into that area now. So all of the pharmaceutical ingredients would have been tested, I would assume, and that's already happening in. Now, it's very interesting that, you know, as I said, in China, we won't get a look in China. How ironic is that? We won't get a look in China because they insist on animal testing. I don't think so. I don't think anybody... Nah, I don't think so. I don't think they know, really. Maybe you're right. You've got a devious mind, haven't you? Never thought about that.
Okay, thank you. Could you also give your name and institutional affiliation when you ask your question? Yes, the gentleman over here.
Hi, my name's Kayvon, studying at LSE. I was hoping you could talk about that time when you took Body Shop public and what were your motivations for doing so, and also... Did you foresee making that many sacrifices when it did go public? And did you expect your shareholders to have a different frame of mind to other shareholders?
Oh, we were so naive. I mean, we didn't go to business school. I was a teacher. Gordon was a poet. He was he just left me and went on a bloody horse from Buenos Aires to New York. I mean, you know, you Scots, they're all crazy, the Scots. It was meant to be a livelihood. Then when he came back from his trip, we were going to immigrate, and we had the passage and everything paid to go to Australia and open up a pineapple plantation. So it wasn't business. So when I set up the body shop, which was just treading water until he came back, what I found I was good at was, which is part of the entrepreneurial, the immigrant sense of entrepreneurship. It's very hard to be an entrepreneur if you're middle class and you've got wealthy. It's very, very interesting for me to watch my daughter, who's setting up her own business, whether it's going to work. I'm sure it will. But it's, you know, she hasn't got the passion, she hasn't got the need, she hasn't come out of poverty like, you know, I, as an Italian immigrant. My family were not poor, but they were not bloody rich, they weren't middle class. So it grew like Topsy. What we were then, when we had about 50 or 60, maybe even 100 shops, which are, I mean, they're only as big as this table, some of them. We only had 20 products to start. It was very interesting when somebody said, well, why did you go onto the US, the unlisted securities market, which I think is like the AIM now. And we had to get everything in order. We had to go and get the, you know, finances in order, whatever that meant. When we went onto the stock market, it was unbelievable for us because we saw the power of, and I'll use this, sort of vertical integration. Everything we did, we wanted to manufacture. We wanted to prove that those ingredients were not tested on animal, not just finished product. We wanted to have a community. I came from a small community in a place that nobody knows, Littlehampton, West Sussex, home for the newlywed and nearly dead. So community was everything. So when we wanted to give our staff, and this is how we argued that, we wanted to give our staff their own personal wealth. Everybody employed had shares. We wanted to do our own manufacturing. All the right reasons we wanted to go public. And when we went public, it was very heady. You know, it was the first time they brought the BBC cameras into the stock market. We watched this little share go from 50 pence, zoom up to 150 pence, and then suddenly everything changed. We used to measure, Gordon and I, we used to go to bed and think, oh my God, we're employing 50 people. Oh, it's 100 people, 120 people. Our measurement for success was employment. Then it suddenly became money. Oh, you're worth 5 million, you're worth 6 million. And I remember the smart thing we did, straight on, we left London after the big hoopla launch. We had this bucket of bolts, this old common van, and we said, let's put obstacles into being like these big companies that we didn't like. We brought in teachers who did all our community volunteering, put an educational process going on. We were not worried about going public then because we had the money, we built the manufacturing plant, we had the child development center. It was just amazing. Then when the shit hits the fan, metaphorically here, and when your shares are no longer celestial, instead of being like, you know, and now that 60p this year, and if they were going down to 20 or 30, they were still being vastly profitable. But the greed for the city was so enormous that we realized that we were now being measured only by one thing, which is its unimaginative bottom line. So when we look back, Gordon and I will say it was the worst mistake we ever made going public, because it impelled you, when you're successful, to hurry to be more successful in other people's terms. If we had not have been gone public, we would still be doing, no, we would be where we are now, maybe not. We wouldn't have been obsessed with growth. We would have said, no, hey, we want a lifestyle, we want balance, we want to have more fun. We wouldn't have been obsessed by being marginalized, and we would not have had the media obsession on us, which was so debilitating and so utterly time-wasting. What do you think? What are they doing? A so-called ethical company. Oh, we found a chemical dye somewhere. You know, it was just, we had a corporate stalker for 4 years who just his one job was trying to destroy us. Ben and Jerry, seventh generation, all these good American so-called progressive companies. So now, you know, we tried to go private 3 or 4 times and we got to the end and we just lost the courage because you're actually in bed with banks. At least we know, you know, how to deal with this. And we realized, too, that setting up a company, which I'm really good at, is one thing. The skill that you have to set something up is not the same skills you have to manage this hugely burgeoning business.
So it's, you know, it's so I'm no longer there in terms of, I'm of course a major shareholder, I'm on the executive non-exec director, and I still work some 50 days a year with the Body Shop, but it's a different animal. And the city loves it now because they're talking to the blokes, it's hierarchical. And you'll find one of the saddest things about growth, any of you, that hierarchy comes in when you least expect it. And when hierarchy comes in, rules and regulations suddenly, just appear. And creativity is really snuffed out. And that's one of the tragedies of growth. And one of the reasons why women entrepreneurs who hate hierarchy and try and destroy it at any given time, it doesn't often work for them. But no, I regret it. And if I'd have known now, then what I know now, I would not have gone. Like I wouldn't have gone to the Moors of America. Monuments to mediocrity. But that's where trading is done. So you learn your lessons. But somebody once said to me finally on this, when I left the Body Shop, and it was totally and utterly painful because it was my umbilical cord, it was my reason for being, it was my, you know, it made me feel alive because of the special, the social, you know, stuff that we were doing. And we did some amazing things. We put the Articles of Association, the legal entity of the role of the business for social and environmental change and human rights advocacy. I don't think anybody else had even thought of doing that. But how bloody wonderful that was when new people come in and they want to maybe destroy it, or they... financial investors say we don't, they'd have to get 75% would have to get together and vote that out, and they're not likely to do that. Somebody once said to me, you're never remembered for what you do in business, you're only remembered for what you do in civil society. And that was a real epiphany for me when I moved away from the Body Shop. That was a long answer, sorry. Gentlemen,
thank
up
you.
There.
Yes, the lady here, yes, and I wanted to take someone on the left hand, on the left over there, the gentleman over there, yeah.
Hello.
So if you would like to start here. Can
Thanks.
You give us your name and institution affiliation?
My name is Hermina. I don't really represent any kind of institution. My question, though, is about the future. I'm just listening to you talk so passionately about how you ran your business and how you still are involved with it. The only real other businessman or person that I've heard speak is Richard Branson, and he's a completely different animal compared to you, but still very passionate. And yet, I'm not sure if there are going to be anyone in our generation who will speak so passionately but have those same principles or similar principles that you hold so dearly, because we are of the generation which is, I want more. And again, about the future, in terms of domestic public policy, you've seen the government favouring social enterprises so much more, and it's seen as a middle, a cutthroat business and something that's trying to do something positive for the community as well. And I was slightly surprised that you didn't mention that in your presentation. Anything, so just to hear your comments about social enterprises would be helpful.
Thank you.
Well, we set up one of the best social enterprises in this country, which was a big issue. And that has really worked. And what we learned from that is you have to be sexy. And we stole the idea, or took the idea from a street newspaper in New York, the Street News it was called, but it was an advocacy newspaper. What we wanted was something that, you know, everybody wanted to be in, wanted to be on the cover on, and it has been phenomenal, not only in this country, but, you know, Leningrad. I mean, the street newspaper now, you know, enterprises are really fertile and doing really well. So, and I do a surgery in my office, you know, once a month, you know, for people, just people like yourself, who says, I've got this idea, what do you think? And I say, oh, there's a good network here. And, you know, I love doing it. It's just some of the things I want to do. Very few have come to me with social enterprises as an idea, very few. So whether or not there is a lack of imagination, I don't know. And passion in terms of this, you know, you say that your age group, it's all about wanting more. Let me tell you something that I think is really powerful. Language controls you. Wittgenstein said, words create your world. The language today is economic. You know, you are put on this planet not to be a good lover or wife or a mistress or a friend or a mother, father, mother, grandmother, whatever. Your life is to be, as seen by the media, homo economicus. Your purpose on life is to keep the economy going. If we read the words, if we see the imaging, if we react to the billboarding, businesses aren't found in nature, aren't deemed by God or the gods or both. They're made by men and women and controlled, and the media. And I think you can challenge that. And I think one of the biggest areas of challenge is the growth of an NGO movement. When I was your age, it was just probably a few people, you know, saving or raising some money for a poor charity, a poor village in Africa. 40,000 NGOs in this world alone on environmental issues. They're believed more. Politicians are not believed. I mean, business people are not believed. It's the NGO, civil society, that's believed. So I think there's ways of getting around it. I'm not quite sure yet what they would be. And anything that deals with the local community, support the local community.
Okay, and we'll take someone on the left.
Hello, Damon Eaton, my name's Peter. In the short term, given that the legislation you proposed in your presentation would be quite difficult and time-consuming to pass, what would your advice and recommendations be to those companies and individuals who are currently involved in CSR programs that are, as you acknowledge, very audit-centric? Could that model be improved in the short term, or should it just be abandoned?
Never abandon anything. The press will get you. I think you can start with purchasing. I think one of the most powerful guardians at the gateposts are purchasing, the purchasing department. I think if the purchasing departments gathered together, you know, in a particular company, let's say in the body shop, like we've had a meeting recently, and just saying that how do we ask, how do we deal, what's our relationship with, are we kinder to these smaller communities, do we say you want payment in 30 days or else, or can we help you set something up? So I think there's an avenue of change in that area there. I'm not that impressed with the human resources department. It depends on where you are, but I do think those who, in terms of purchasing, have got the answer. So if you can find ways of, and aligning, getting other companies to work together. I mean, one of the most important things that we, my company, should be doing now is working with those other companies that are trading in it. Every factory in China, if they're making shoes for Adidas, they're making shoes for Nike, and they're making shoes for Reebok. You know, that's their skill. And we should be looking at companies, let's say in, I don't know, whatever they be, and finding out what are you making. If you and Gap and Body Shop and got together and we said, this is what we demand from these factories. You know, the wage structure, you know, the right to be represented, all of the stuff that makes for an honorable relationship with the employees. I think you could do it, but it's networking, it's strategic alliances, and it's time.
Thank you. Yes, one question here.
Hi, my name is Ryan Menton from University of East London. Anita, when the body shop was first formed and as it started to become bigger, it must have been quite a challenge to persuade all the people around you conducting business that this was being ethical was the best way to go about things. Can you tell me a little bit about how you went about conducting this challenge in a way?
Do you know what? In truth, if I had my hand on my heart, when we set up in 1976, we could not have spelt the word environment. It just wasn't the issue. What we did, which was really smart, we had thought leaders, in this case for us, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, Amnesty, they led us, because we were always activists anyway in our life, they led us into this new thinking. It wasn't business, we never belonged to any chamber of commerce, we just took the activist groups that we supported and listened to them. Now, with that knowledge that they gave us, and nobody's ever got this in the body shop. We were a communications company for nigh on 23 years when I was running it. It was all about communications of the issues that I cared about. It's like a benign dictatorship. And we had communications departments, marketing, a marketing department. I don't know if we even called it a marketing. We didn't even have a marketing department for 18 years. We never quite knew what it did. You know, what does marketing do? Is it a science? Is it not? We're ambivalent. We got lots of awards, but we didn't quite have a department. Everything was communications. So we put, whether it was in internally, and it was like a concentric circle, the most important people we had to communicate was our employees. People at 80%, 90%, 100% of their time were talking to customers. And then it became less and less and less. Every vehicle was something that had to be sexy, had to be interesting, had to be educational. We had trucks. We never paid a penny in advertising. We had trucks, about 30 of them, going up and down the highways of England. They became moving billboards. We had one great one against the Minister of Education in the early days, and it read, you know, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. And we had the home phone number of the minister, an office number of the Minister of Education. So we were using cute tech, and it was this type of style and image that people got to understand. We never used the word ethics, and that's where language played a lot. We used a lot of poetry, a lot of metaphysical. We had more from, there's an American poet called Walt Whitman. He became more of our sort of in-house poet because we love the words and the language. And I have to say, you know, it's really cranky and peculiar how we did things. And then I guess we would definitely start to be listened to when financially we're deemed as successful, because the argument was always, well, how can you do this and still be this? So it was like the terrorism of the ore. Can you do this or you can't? You know, I said, well, let's include the genius of the and. You can be profitable and you can be, you know, you can be ethical or whatever they like to say. But we had to find ways of getting people to understand. So I'd say, well, you know, we don't fly first class. We don't pay obscene pay packages, you know. We haven't got trophy brides, you know. We haven't got big, bloody, great Rolls Royces. So, I mean, my God, let me tell you, there are ways of, you know, saving money in a company. So I don't think we ever had a hard time persuading anybody, because we put our own toe in the water and we proved it could be done. We proved that you can get onto the stock market, your shares defied gravity, and still give back to the community. We proved that you can open up 150 shops a year and still fight with a fierce passion for human rights. We proved you could do it. The dilemma was sustaining it. You know, that was it.
Thank you. I've got two questions, one in the front row and one, the lady with the green scarf. So I'll take this one first.
Thank you. Armin Ishkanian, Center for Civil Society, LSE. You mentioned NGOs, and I wanted your comments on what you think, what type of relationship NGOs should have with business.
I think every major business should have an NGO on its as a non-exec, if that's relevant to what they're dealing with. We could not have moved in terms of our campaigns and knowledge without, whether it would be, you know, Amnesty International, the World Development Movement. We just got our information from these people. So, and I think they bring in a bigger understanding of the global dilemmas, whether it's poverty or whether it's social alienation, and they can give you a much more informed way of how the world is working. So that's, I think it's really cool if companies say, yeah, we know, we sit and talk to Greenpeace, we sit and talk to, you know, Amnesty, you know, we sit, whether it's talking about it, it's getting information. So I'm a great lover of many, not the ones that the oligarchy are producing, because the oligarchy now are coming up with their own little NGOs, little shit bags.
Thank you. And the young woman with the green scarf.
Hi, my name is Nikki Weston, and I'm a graduate student here at LSE. And I was wondering, on one hand, you advocate for corporate regulation, but on the other hand, there seems to be an implication in your argument that multinationals have special obligations, perhaps in virtue of their power, that go beyond good management. How do you reconcile these two competing or even contradictory claims?
I'm sorry, what's my contradiction?
First of all, on one hand, you seem to be espousing for corporate regulation, and that's the primary way to go. But then on the other hand, in your argument, you sort of, there's this implication that multinationals, because of their power, have special obligations besides just you know, good business practice.
Well, you know, if people can control the lives of so many, and, you know, I don't know about you, but I travel into the epicenters of despair, whether it's Bangladesh in the sweatshops or wherever, and if what we've got working with us now is a slavery economy, and it is that, and somebody's got to wake up to this in business schools, here, everywhere, and the media. And if the huge corporations, the huge multinational corporations who do have a stranglehold on things, that is a reality, and control the World Trade Organization, and control GATT, and control NAFTA, it's huge power, you know. I think they have an obligation. They have an obligation, as I said, you know, not just to maximize profit, but only to do that if it doesn't get in the way of human rights. The biggest dilemma with these corporations is on the dilemma of wages. Nobody wants to pay the living wage in the country. I've got information and film footage of Walmart, the most heinous company on God's planet. End of story. Just if you want to hate something, project it there, right? Don't waste it, just project it there. Of the 190, 290, I can't remember how many, of their agents in Bangladesh, going around in the factories, demanding, because they can't They can't manipulate anything else. It's so much as fixed costs. You know, fixed costs for taking these thousands of, you know, shirts or whatever they're doing, importing or exporting it to the USA. A lot of the fixed costs are there. The only one that's not a fixed cost is labor. So from 39 cents to live on in Bangladesh to 22 cents, what they're living on now, to 14 cents, which is what Walmart wants, and this is proven. You know, I think there is a huge dilemma. And I also think that the small companies can act in a way, and I don't, you know, I think they're lighter of foot. They're not so compounded by this need to maximize profits. I'm not answering your question because I think I don't get the first bit.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to take...
And I'm sorry for that. I just didn't quite get the first bit. I wonder if this gentleman here, he's looking... You've given up wanting to ask a question. Go on, I favoured you. Let him answer. I've got 10 minutes.
Yeah,
we've got to go with some up there, of course. Yeah. Three at least.
G. Leslie, regarding trade, what can be done to stop consumers being conned by so-called ethical producers? I believe that Kenko and Nestle are going to launch ethical coffee brands certificated by a body called the Rainbow Alliance, not by the Fair Trade Foundation, which demands minimum wage payments. What can consumers do to stop being conned? And in the field of human rights, you showed in that office Aung San Suu Kyi. So what can be done with regard to human rights with consumers fighting for what's going on in Burma, or the Dalai Lama, because I know in Nepal's just shut down his office on the border. Okay. What do you reckon should be done about those sort of things?
I don't know what can be done, because I think everyone here in this audience, anywhere in the world, wants a feeling of being alive, a feeling alive. For me, working on these issues, whether it's trade justice or sweatshop labor, working to three men who've been in solitary confinement for 35 years in Louisiana, it makes me feel alive when I do this. When I go beyond my own skin and my own comfort zone, it makes me feel alive. So the question really is, why don't people give a damn? What are we so immune to? And maybe it's something to do with these thousands and thousands and thousands of ads bombarding us saying, you know, this is what you've got to buy. I don't know. Maybe it's looking as a woman looking at a magazine and saying, oh my God, my boobs are droopy and I've got dimples on my bum and I've got crow's feet around my eyes. So often the trash heap of life we go. Maybe it's a manufactured but brilliant strategy to keep people passive. Maybe it's a celebration of just nothing in our media other than celebrity and entertainment, you know, and frocks and the bloody Oscars. Maybe, I don't know what it is. But it seems to me that I think people like the audience here, people like the choir and people like yourselves in asking the question, we know how to find out who the false and who are the false ones. You know, we know that. We just get on, we read great, you know, the research by Christian Aid, we go onto the web, we find it out. I don't know what to do about it. I just wish to God there was more investigation in some of the media, really, instead of, you know, and the media won't touch it. The media, because if it gets in the way of advertising money, they won't touch it. They won't touch one. They won't touch Disney to the extent they should. And neither I think they've touched Nestle. But I think, you know, maybe, just maybe, the grassroots movement, people like you, people like all of us, we make our own decisions. And the answer isn't boycott. As I said, the answer is shaming. You shame by letter writing. If my company had 500 letters, 50 letters on one issue, by God, did people wake up. And do what the Council of Churches do in Canada and here. You know, they buy shares into a company they loathe. And stand up at the annual general meetings and shame them with you know, good questions. These are all great techniques.
Thank you. Let's have a few questions on the balcony. Can I take two or one?
Yeah.
Can you speak up?
One of the solutions you have found is reporting and accountability, as I have seen in the presentation. But there are a lot of tendencies towards self-regulation and for companies voluntarily reporting. Do you believe this in any way can work, or it's only obligatory measures that you believe?
No, I don't think it can work. I think the auditing procedures are all up the spout. There's no standard. No, I don't think it will work. I think, and the dilemma too is transparency. So many companies do their audit, but it's a snapshot of any time. So I think it should be regulated.
Thank you. One last question. I think I have the
up there.
Oh, oh, this one. Take, yeah. Then.
Well, if you took a notice, and I don't know quite what the headline was, but it was, for me, it was CSR from corporate social, from corporate responsibility to corporate accountability. I think it is a journey. But I think if you keep on, I don't believe that being responsible loses money. I believe you waste so much money in businesses in ways you wouldn't even know, well, of course you'd know about it, because you're dealing with this. So this idea that everything costs too much to do this stuff, I don't believe is true. I do believe there's one of these silent stakeholders that we never hear enough of, and that's the environmental impact on, you know, what should be our most protected stakeholder, which is what provides us our resources, which is the environment. So I agree with you. I think it is a journey. But as I said, you know, from the time when many of us in the West Coast of America, some of the crazy people who got together and said, let's talk about social responsibility in business in the late 80s. You know, I think we'd be broken-hearted, as I am, about how it's just been auditing, auditing, auditing. Anyway, but being Italian, I'm optimistic, okay, as I said. Thank you very much.
That was some I just wanted to say before you leave that I wanted to share with you one of Anita's favourite sayings and also issue a warning. One of Anita's favourite sayings is, a woman in advancing old age is unstoppable by any earthly force. And the warning is to China. So Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao, listen. Anita is coming and she will be unstoppable.